People are actually losing their homes and asking to rent in our apartments.
The biggest obstacle is, of course, lack of funds.
We think we've helped 58,000 people.
We're constantly having a greater demand for affordable housing.
Welcome to the Affordable Housing Podcast, brought to you by Eden Housing.
For more than a decade, Stephanie Martin Taylor has walked the streets of San Francisco and the Bay Area learning and reporting on the housing issues of our region. She's talked with real people and heard their personal stories. Hi, I'm Joanne Green, and on this episode of the Affordable Housing Podcast, brought to you by Eden Housing, I'm speaking with Stephanie Martin Taylor, formerly an anchor and housing reporter for KQED Radio, and now the newly named communications director for the Episcopal Diocese of California. An award-winning journalist based in San Francisco, Stephanie has been focused on housing and development issues. She has a graduate degree in journalism from Columbia, an undergraduate degree from Colgate, and was a White House intern. Stephanie, welcome to the Affordable Housing Podcast. I'm going to resist the temptation to ask you about your experiences in the White House and move straight to how and why you became so interested in housing.
Well, basically, you know, you just can't get away from it here, especially in San Francisco, where I live and work. I found myself doing more general assignment work at KQED, but every time I ran across a story that interested me, it seemed to have something to do with housing affordability. It really began around the time when we were dealing with the recession and the housing crisis that was happening out in the East Bay with foreclosures. And I was talking to a lot of people about losing their homes and that really emotional experience of a place that you call home suddenly being pulled out from underneath them. And so next thing I knew, I was being named the housing reporter because I just was already doing so many stories on housing.
You had a personal experience as well, right?
I do. I joke that I married my husband for rent control. I got married 2.5 years ago.
There are worse reasons, right?
but prior to that, I'm kidding, of course. But it is true. I'm very grateful for my rent control here in San Francisco. There's no way I would actually be able to live here any other way. But basically, it was about 5 years ago when the economy was picking up again. I was living in Noe Valley, which is a very hot neighborhood right now. And my landlord decided it was time to sell. And it was a really traumatic experience because my downstairs neighbors and I suddenly found ourselves with no control over the fact that we had people coming through our apartment. And we had no idea what the landlord's real plans were to, but he was actually making it a tenancy in common. Tenancy in common was how he advertised it, but you know, was the person who was buying the place going to keep one of us, kick us both out? We didn't really know, and it was really stressful. I ended up taking a buyout and moving to the East Bay to the Pleasant Hill area, Pleasant Hill Walnut Creek area, which is not rent controlled. And I immediately realized once I got out there that I was going to have to move again because my rent went up after a year. Luckily, I got married and got the rent control in San Francisco, but it was just a really stressful experience because I looked around San Francisco. I had a dog at the time. I couldn't find anything that worked. And this was where I'd built my community.
And this is the experience of so many people where you end up having to go move further and further from your workplace, which adds what you must have had at least an hour long commute.
Yes, I was taking BART or driving in, and that was a whole new experience for me. And I felt very cut off from this community that I'd worked really hard to build. I'd been in San Francisco at that point for about 6.5 years. And suddenly I was spending all my time either on BART or in the car and not going to my church and not volunteering anymore because I just didn't have time.
I'm sure that you spoke to many people over the years who faced housing insecurity and the kind of stress that results from that. Is there any one particular story that stuck with you?
I think the story that I'll always remember is going to a housing lottery recently. It was held in, the lottery was actually held in the Tenderloin, but the actual property was going to be, I believe it was around the Western Addition neighborhood in San Francisco. And it was thousands of people, thousands, buying for just a few hundred units. And just, I think what was really heartbreaking was just talking to individuals. You know, I talked to one woman who just said, you know, she was there for her mother who was sick and had been moving around and, you know, just not able to stay in one place for very long. She had, her mother had all kinds of health problems. And it was like she was holding, I mean, it was a lottery ticket. She was holding a lottery ticket in her hand, but this was her last hope, is to win this lottery. And she talked to me with some degree of hope. She was really hoping to get a space in this unit. And it was just so sad realizing in my heart, knowing that her odds were not very good. And finally, after the lottery took place, I saw her from a distance looking really dejected and walking out and, you know, walking back to have to tell her mother that she didn't get a unit.
So what options would someone like her have open to them?
Basically, you're looking at getting on a wait list for affordable housing. And these wait lists are very, very long and can take years to get through. So that's not really, that's an option, but not much of an option. I mean, you really, either you get lucky and get a space in an affordable housing community, or you just keep moving out, or at worst case scenario, you become homeless.
Right. And many people, of course, rely on family members. How many people are we talking about who are facing that level of housing insecurity in San Francisco specifically?
Oh, goodness. I don't have the numbers on the top of my head, but it's, you know, when you consider that the majority of people living in San Francisco are renters, it's a good portion of the city, because most of these units that are, even though a lot of new buildings are being built that are not under rent control, the majority of the rental housing stock is rent controlled. So nobody's in that pool owns their units. And at the end of the day, they can be evicted or the landlord could sell. So we're all insecure in some ways. I'm insecure. My housing is insecure. We don't own our unit. Our landlords could sell, and we would not stay in the city, most likely.
Hearing actual stories about how people have been impacted really gives a face to the housing crisis. But we all know that oftentimes communities will oppose development of housing, and in particular affordable housing, in their neighborhoods. So how do you think these stories of real people might be helpful in persuading folks to make more room in their communities?
Yeah, I think you really have to appeal to people's compassion. It's really easy to oppose a building because that's a very impersonal, it's a structure. It doesn't have a heart. So that's where reporters come in. That's where nonprofits and their storytelling folks come in to really put a face on it and to get people, you know, at the community meetings who are actually going through these very traumatic events, and for people who have to express their hope for new housing to be built, to speak up and speak before communities. So I think you really need more community forums. You really need to put the people and the faces first as much as possible, because then those who might oppose housing projects are more likely to be able to put themselves in the shoes of the people who can benefit from them.
Have you seen that shift happen? Have you ever been at one of these meetings and seen someone, that moment, that epiphany moment where they get it, that this isn't just a building, but it's people?
You know, I don't know if I've actually seen the epiphany. I felt the epiphany myself. As a reporter, it's always been my job to see both sides, to feel both sides. but I'm a human being. So, you know, when I'm looking at an issue where I can understand why a community might be afraid of putting in something that's going to create more traffic or possibly noise, you know, I can feel for that. But then when you see a person come to the microphone who is, you know, has a child, for example, in the school system, and they may have to pull that child out of school and move to a completely different district, which is really disruptive for children. You know, as a reporter, you know, I have to report that objectively, but it's also, you know, tugging on my heartstrings, and I can really see why, all things being equal, erring on the side of allowing more housing, even if that means some other nuisances like noise, would be the right decision.
San Francisco's really been the epicenter of displacement concerns, and evictions, as I understand, are rising rapidly. Can you share with us your experience around this?
Yeah, I mean, I have friends who have been evicted. It's not just my reporting work. It's, you know, I have a friend who her apartment building was Ellis'd, which means it was the landlord went out of the rental business and using the state law, the Ellis Act, and basically emptied out the entire building. And she's no longer living in San Francisco. In fact, she moved to New York. And that was traumatic for her. That was, you know, again, her whole community. She had to rethink her job. Luckily, she had the kind of job which was portable, so she was able to move to another city. But it's happening to people I know. So I don't even have to go out into my reporting to think about evictions. And I talk to people. In my reporting, I've talked to people all the time who've been on the verge of eviction, fighting eviction. You know, there have been fights in San Francisco to help keep very elderly people in their apartments. I remember there was a case of a woman who was in her late 80s, who she'd lived there for decades. I believe it was in the Mission District or somewhere around there, but she was, you know, having health problems because it was clear that the landlord wanted her out.
Stephanie, I know there's a question of whether to reform or repeal the Ellis Act. Can you tell us a little bit more about the act and why it's become so controversial?
Yeah, the Ellis Act is the state law that, as I mentioned earlier, allows landlords to go out of business, which is in many ways very well intentioned because, you know, landlords are not, when we're talking about small landlords, mom and pop landlords, they're not running charities. They're trying to boost their own retirement savings, and, you know, they see their properties as an investment and an income stream. But the problem is there have been some landlords who've abused the Ellis Act, and there are some landlords who will use it to flip properties, essentially, when the economy is good, like it is now here in San Francisco. So I know State Senator Mark Leno had been working very hard to try to overturn it or reform it on the state level, but the pushback comes from other communities that don't have the same issues that San Francisco or LA have. They're not the big urban areas, so it's hard to get the entire state on board when other communities are protective of it.
Got it. Now, new construction is an issue too. I understand it's not so easy to build in San Francisco these days.
Yeah, there's a lot of construction going on, but one thing you hear about a lot from builders is the burden of CEQA, that is the California Environmental Quality Act. Again, that's another very well-intentioned state law designed to protect the environment by making it, having developers go through a process to make sure everything is environmentally sound and is not going to harm the community. But it, that also can be abused. And folks who are opposed to a development might invoke CEQA to hold up the project, to bog it down in red tape. And so there has been a lot of back and forth over whether CEQA should be reformed so that housing can happen a lot faster in places like San Francisco.
Let's talk specifically about affordable housing for a moment. Is the supply in any way meeting the demand from your perspective?
No, absolutely not. And what's even, you know, on the low end, a lot of building is happening on the very low income. But when it comes to that middle income, when we're talking about teachers and firefighters and journalists and just regular folks who are not working in super high paying jobs, there's also that, you know, that middle income that's being forced out. So really, it's a huge problem. And more buildings are coming online, but in terms of meeting the needs of essential workers, no, it's not anywhere close.
What would you say are the intelligent next steps? I mean, what's needed to address this crisis?
Well, honestly, it's more money. It's also community support. We have a lot of areas, especially in San Francisco, that could build up. I'm talking about places like the Sunset District, the Richmond. You'll notice most of the development is happening south of Market, but also, not surprisingly, perhaps, that's an area that's near the financial district, and that's becoming the most expensive area of town to live. So a lot of it has to do with zoning. Zoning for more housing in, again, places like the Sunset where you can build up. And that's very controversial because people love their neighborhoods and these neighborhoods are very distinct and have character to them. And people who have bought in places like the Sunset or the Presidio area, they bought there believing that they're going to get a certain kind of lifestyle. So understandably, there's pushback, but we need to figure out better ways to make compromises with folks and appeal again to their compassion. Otherwise, this is going to be a city primarily for the rich.
The very rich and the very poor, and not for anybody in between. So you left your career as a radio journalist focused on housing, and now you're working for the Episcopal Diocese of California. Why did you make that shift?
It was something that I'd been thinking about for a while, not specifically the Episcopal Diocese, but I'd really been, as I did this work reporting on the housing crisis, I felt like I wanted to be part of the solution. And the Episcopal Diocese is working on, of course, they're involved in homeless housing and other and issues that are related to housing. But I felt like I really wanted to be able to have a voice, an independent voice in the discussion. And now it turns out I'm going to be working on the Interfaith Task Force for Housing here in San Francisco, looking at trying to develop underused church properties for affordable housing. So that's really exciting to me. I'll miss my career as a journalist, but I also feel like in some ways I'm continuing my work just in a more proactive way.
Absolutely. Are you hopeful?
I am hopeful. I think there are a lot of people working on this issue. I think ultimately the solution isn't city by city, but it has to be a Bay Area coordinated effort where we have to all realize that San Francisco's problems are also Oakland's problems. They're also Fremont's problems. They're also Palo Alto's problems. And I believe that city officials are realizing that more and more, and solutions are on the horizon. It's going to be a ways out, though.
Sure. Well, we are grateful for your efforts, both as a journalist and now, dare I say, as an activist?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Will do. Stephanie, thanks so much for your insights today.
Thank you.
Stephanie Martin Taylor, former KQED radio anchor reporter focused on housing issues, now communications director for the Episcopal Diocese of California. I'm Joanne Green. To hear prior episodes of the Affordable Housing Podcast, please visit iTunes or edenhousing.org.